welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibe. We've got an all-music edition of Culturetopia this week, starting with the creators of the kid show Yo Gabba Gabba. They're talking about booking the bands they love and winning some unexpected fans. The son of a late, great Cuban band leader discusses his father's legacy, and the singer and actress Jill Scott talks about the similarities between her two creative pursuits. But first...
That's Hot Hot Heat, the indie folk band out of British Columbia, singing a song that urges children and their parents to get up off the couch and go outdoors. They might also be reaching a lot of students and other viewers, too. Yo Gabba Gabba began on the Nick Jr. TV network as a show to entertain and educate the pre-K set. But now, as it prepares to shoot its fourth season, the show's popularity is busting demographic boundaries. Original songs performed by popular bands including The Killers, The Roots, and Weezer have snagged teenage and older fans who enjoy the often psychedelic performances. The show was nominated for two 2011 Daytime Emmy Awards. Joined now by the co-creators, Christian Jacobs and Scott Schultz, who are out at NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. Yeah. Thanks for having us.
How do we tell the difference between your two voices?
I think mine is the better one.
I think mine's the deeper one.
All right, so Christian Jacobs has the somewhat deeper voice. Or the somewhat
no, that would be Scott.
All right.
Scott is the maybe deeper. Mine's a little more nasally.
So let me ask the nasal voice first, then.
Sure.
Did you just set out to do a show that didn't sound too much like Barney?
Yeah. As first-time dads, when we were sitting down, we were so excited to, you know, watch television with our kids and really participate. Mm-hmm. And we just felt like, not that everything was wrong with preschool television, but that there was so much more that we could bring to the table. Maybe naively so, we were thinking, why not have new great animators on every week and new bands, new celebrities? You know, we could really create this sort of, you know, dream television show that we wanted to make. And I guess we were just naive enough to think, like, of course, we should just do it. Why not? You know? We'll roll up to Television USA and say, we have a show idea.
Call the president of show business. We're ready.
Mr. Hollywood, please put us on the air.
So, I mean, how did you get that done? Because, I mean, the first answer is usually, you know, where's the marketing study?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we're not television executives. We're not child psychologists. We're just dads who love our kids and want to share things with them. And Scott and I both had a production background. We actually cut our teeth making skateboard videos and local music videos for bands. And so we just pooled our resources together and grabbed some friends and took out loans on our houses and just we went for it. So
yeah, I mean, I think it was a really strange collaboration, bringing in all our friends, all of our influences, all the people, you know, around us that helped shape the show in little ways. Like Biz Markie was in the pilot. He really showed up and pretty much created Biz's Beats of the Day. He said, you know, I want to be Mr. Rogers for kids. And we said, of course you should be. You know?
Yeah, why so not?
Hey, kids, just gather around for Biz's Beat of the Day. I'm going to teach you some sounds. Okay, here's Biz's Beat of the Day. Now practice this at home, and I'll see y'all next time. Bye-bye.
Biz Markie, Mos Def, Jack Black, Sarah Silverman, they're not always known as family-friendly entertainers.
That is true.
Although Jack Black, of course, is Kung Fu Panda, as probably we can tell each other.
We do try to look for the energy and the motivation. And with Jack Black, you know, he's got kids himself, and he wanted to be on the show because he loved watching the show with his kids. And I think that energy really is a pure thing. It's really fun and contagious.
My dancey dance is called the disco roll, and this is how you do it. First, you point up to the sky.
Up to the sky.
Then you point down to the ground.
Down to the ground.
Then you do it again. Up to the sky.
We weren't trying to do what has been predetermined is a kid's show song or a kid's show celebrity. We didn't want to pander to the kids or talk down to them. We felt like we could take a band that we love and ask them to play a song that had lyrics that kids could understand and relate to and that kids would like it. You know, these people that aren't traditionally kids show friendly, I think when they come to the table, they bring this sort of like fun awe. You know, I guess they're in awe of being a kid again, and we get to celebrate in this kind of idea that we're being kids again together, and we're just doing something that kids can relate to.
We have a recording, The Roots performing Lovely Love My Family. Sometimes when I am sitting by myself, those quiet moments when I'm with no one else, I'm mesmerized by all the many good things in my life. I think about the time when I was younger, and the older that I get, the more that I feel wiser. The love of friends and family gets stronger, and it carries me on through. This is a really nice song.
Yeah, we like it.
When did you begin to understand that Yo Gabba Gabba was catching on outside the demographic that you'd kind of penciled in?
That's interesting that you use The Roots right there, because first season, you know, Elijah Wood was on the show, and we had the Shins on the show, and some people that we really respected. And one of the things we were trying for is to have The Roots be a part of the show. And when we actually got a hold of them, this was during the second season, I was talking to Amir, the drummer, also known as Questlove, and he was like, yeah, and he cut me off mid-sentence, and he finished the description of the segment, and he said, "Christian, we watch the show every day at our house. We can't wait to be on the show." And I was blown away, because here's this band I've looked up to, and Amir is an amazing drummer, and I realized, wow, like, the show is touched a lot of people, and people that have touched us. Come with us on a spaceship adventure, flying through the galaxy. We'll travel far to see sparkling beauty.
Scott Schultz and Christian Jacobs, they are co-creators of the Nick Jr. TV show, Yo Gabba Gabba, speaking with us from NPR West. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure to talk with both of you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Mr. Simon.
This thanks for having us.
Our pleasure.
And you can watch The Roots performance on Yo Gabba Gabba at nprmusic.org. And this is Weekend Edition from NPR News, directed by Elaine Heinzman, produced by Gemma Waters, Walter Watson, Amy Held, Justin O'Neill, Claudine Ubaid, Chris Benderev, and Megan Keane. We welcome our new interns, Rebecca Hersher and Allison Seiss. Jeffrey Bennett and Deborah George have edited our program. Our technical director is Burke Gabba Gabba Hun, our librarian, Kim Oleski. This goes our web producer. Our show was produced today by Ned Wharton and edited by Antonio Marcano. Sarah Lucy Oliver is our supervising producer, and the senior supervising producer of Weekend Edition is Bridget Kelly. I'm Scott Simon.
It's summertime.
Now, the latest in our series on the sounds of summer. Today, writer Tom Manoff celebrates a campfire from long ago.
Mohegan Beach, 1961. Six teenage boys sitting around a fire late into the night. Stars everywhere, shining above the darkness of the lake. And the sound of the fire, soothing but alive with the energy of promise. After some baseball talk, someone would start up a discussion about the meaning of life. 14-year-old philosophers we were. And at that age, we didn't talk about girls. Late-night fires were a boy's thing. Inevitably, a few guitars came out, and six young teenage boys with cracking voices sang tunes from the Joan Baez songbook. Kumbaya, whatever the meaning of life was, there seemed to be more of it with guitars. Today, I'm a little embarrassed at the memory of that guitar sound, especially the songs that began with a D chord, which were all of them. I guess I've become a more lofty personage. When it comes to sounds around the campfire at Lake Mohegan, it's the gentle whoosh of the flames and the sputter from wood that sings in my memory.
Summer Sounds from writer Tom Manoff. Tell us what your summer sounds like, whether it's now or in the summer of your memories. Go to npr.org and click on Contact Us, and please remember to write Summer Sounds in the subject line. Next week for the solstice, we'll read some of your responses on the air.
Cultural reunion. Last December, Arturo Ferro left New York City for Cuba, along with Arturo's mother, his wife, and children, and the legendary orchestra, once led by his father, the composer and arranger Chico O'Farrell. The band headlined the Havana International Jazz Plaza Festival. Chico O'Farrell left Cuba in 1959. He never returned. He made music with artists from Benny Goodman to David Bowie. Chico died 10 years ago at the age of 79, so his son set out to trace his family's roots in Cuba and share the musical legacy of the New York O'Farrells. Bandleader, composer, and pianist Arturo O'Farrell joins us from our studios in New York. Your sons are there too, right?
Yep, it's Adam
and Zach.
Adam, the trumpeter and composer, and Zach, who's a drummer. All the O'Farrells, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's a little bit like being at our breakfast table.
Well, how old are you, Adam and Zach?
Maybe I am 16 years old.
That's Adam.
And I, Zach, am 19 years old.
What was it like to go back to Cuba? I know you've been there before.
It was really not a nostalgia Chico journey. It was a way of connecting my father back to the island that he loved, a way of bringing him peace, and also really a nod to the Cuban people and to the great legacy that they gave our American art form, what we call our American art form, jazz. And so when we went down there, it was about also giving my sons a chance to interact with the future, and of course the Cuban musicians a chance to interact with them as well.
What did you think of your father's music when you were growing up?
I grew up in New York City. My mother and father spoke with an accent, and so I rejected everything Latin or Cuban. The music that he wrote that was jazz, I embraced it, though I wasn't quite yet convinced as a jazz musician. It wasn't until I was 12 that I really discovered Miles Davis and Herbie Hancock that I embraced that part of my father. And I didn't really embrace the Latin Afro-Cuban genius that he was until I was well into my 20s. He would talk to me a lot about Cuba, especially, you know, towards the end of his life. And I remember at one point, he was invited to perform in the same festival that we got to perform in. And that's kind of where this whole dream of continuing the journey for him began. Mm-hmm. And he asked me if he should go back, because for the first time in his life, I saw that in his eyes. And he said he'd like to go.
About what year was this, Arturo?
Oh, my God, this must have been 95, 94. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I advised him to go, but he was too frail and elderly to get on an airplane. And that broke my heart.
O'Farrells, how easy or hard was it for you to go to Cuba with the band?
The band has been on the road. They're all road warriors, and so. And I think Zach and Adam have developed good road warrior chops as well.
I like being on the road.
Sounds like a Discovery Channel show.
I think being on the road is really thrilling.
I always love being on the road, too.
Yeah, and you get to explore different parts of the world with colleagues and friends and family. It's really an incredible experience to be on the road.
What was it like when you landed? I mean, was there a sense of emotion that washed over you?
Every time you get off the plane and actually step on the ground, there's a sense of relief because, you know, out of every country in the world, there are three that you're not legally allowed to travel to from the United States. So you get off the plane, you always feel a sense of relief because it's like you're never really sure that you're actually going to make it there. But also, it's just...
It's very emotional. Yeah. For me, the first time that I landed, I just remember there was a moment where I didn't know what to do. I couldn't walk forward. I couldn't walk backward. I was so overcome by emotion that... You know, it's funny because I was born in Mexico City. I grew up in the United States. But I'm not Cuban and I'm not Mexican and I'm not quite American.
And what was it like for the O'Farrells to be in Havana? I mean, what was the reaction from the audiences there?
There was one concert in a town called San Jose de las Lajas. And we were actually performing for free in a town plaza in front of a church. In the birthplace of my great-grandfather. That's when Adam and Zach really first performed in front of the Cuban public, but I know the band was overwhelmed with emotion.
My favorite moment was probably interacting with all the young Cuban musicians, and it was really, really a treat to see them.
Arturo, do you think in your trips back, and particularly that trip to headline the festival, did something fall into place for you about your father that wasn't there before?
Yeah, but it didn't happen on this trip. Two things happened. Yeah. On one of my prior trips, when we first visited the rural countryside where he was ostensibly brought to repeatedly, I really saw and heard the rhythms of the countryside. And I think when you listen to the Afro-Cuban Jazz Suite, which is Chico Farrell's seminal work, what you're really hearing is you're really hearing the sound of Cuba. So that fell into place. And then another realization that fell into place for me was that everything he wrote, from David Bowie to Ringo Starr to Count Basie to Stan Kenton, had that same contrapuntal concept that you find in a lot of Afro-folkloric music. Virtually ruled all of Chico's compositions and writing. So that fell into place for me.
Arturo O'Farrell, what did you learn from your father?
Oh, man, what a great question. Because I don't know if I learned a lot musically from him, but I learned a lot about courage because he was a gentleman who was driven by integrity to his art. When he got a writing assignment, a composition assignment, a commission or an arrangement, he did not try to pander. I mean, he pushed the envelope on so many levels, and he was a good enough musician to do it successfully, artistically. But I think he never backed down from a challenge. And so when I look at him, and I look at all the great heroes of my life, I see that these are people who don't take an opportunity to replicate, but take an opportunity to create. I also learned he was very, actually kind of soft-spoken, a real sweet man, a real Cuban gentleman. And I never heard him. I was speaking about this the other day. Man, I never heard him cut another musician down. I never heard him disrespect another musician. I never heard him disrespect anyone. And, I mean, I find that in this day and age, sometimes musicians do this. And it's amazing to me because my here's my dad who did all this incredible, groundbreaking work. And I just never heard him say anything negative. And I find that that's an incredible lesson for young musicians.
Arturo O'Farrell, the pianist and composer who leads the Afro-Latin Orchestra, and of course his sons, the drummer Zach O'Farrell and the trumpeter, composer Adam O'Farrell, speaking with us all from New York. Thanks so much.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
Thank you. for listening to Chico O'Farrell's Afro-Cuban Suite. Before that, we heard Ruminaciones sobre Cuba by Arturo O'Farrell and the Chico O'Farrell Orchestra's performance of Almendra. You can learn more about the O'Farrell's trip to Cuba at nprmusic.org.
Our last word in business is one costly guitar riff. More than 700 million people became spontaneous musicians when they visited Google's homepage last week. Google had transformed its logo into a guitar. You could actually strum.
It was posted for 2 days to honor guitar legend Les Paul. The company spent about $15,000 on the design, but the website Extreme Tech says the plethora of plucking, the time spent plucking, cost the world $268 million in lost productivity.
And that time waster is here to stay. Google has given the guitar a permanent online home. And there's a link on Morning Edition's Facebook page. Knock yourselves out.
We'll see if we can get it up over $300 million of lost productivity. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Until you will, I still my heart.
When Jill Scott came on the music scene a little more than a decade ago, she wanted to let the world know just who is Jill Scott. That, in fact, was the title of her debut album.
He let you go a long time ago, now it's time to turn him loose. Let's take a long walk.
Since then, the Philadelphia native has won 3 Grammys, sold 5 million records, and starred in a number of movies and TV shows, from the film Why Did I Get Married to the HBO series The Number One Ladies Detective Agency. Now Jill Scott is back in the music mix with a new album coming out Tuesday. It's called The Light of the Sun, and we caught up with her in her hometown at member station WRTI on the campus of Temple University.
I went here for about 3 years. I was going to teach the wonders of the English language to high school students, 11th grade.
Why'd you change your mind?
I had a principal tell me that I was young and idealistic and that I would get over it. You know, everything about the school was gray. And I said, you guys, you have to understand, these are kids, you know, and they walk in the door and everything is gray. It feels like they're already defeated. I know I feel defeated walking in. We have to get some color on the walls. And that's when the principal told me I was young and idealistic and that I would get over it. Ooh. And I was like, okay, you know what? I won't.
And you walked out and ended up in music. How did that happen?
It started off with poetry. I was reading poetry to my girlfriends, and they were like, you're really good. You should go to some poetry readings or something. And I eventually went and got somewhat of a name for myself and a little bit of a following. And one day I just got up to read a poem and started singing. I looked around, the reaction was great. And I said, oh boy, I like this. Let's see if I could do some more of this.
And now here you are with your new album, Light of the Sun.
Yes.
Let's listen to the first track of this album called Blessed.
This is the last take for the night. Understand that's kind of late. And I gotta get home to my son. Cause he's so special to me. I mean, I gotta see him. I need to breathe him. That's my baby. Don't call me crazy. I love the studio, but I love him more. Let me give you what I got, so.
Jill Scott, this is a song very much about your own life. How do you figure out how much to reveal in your music and how much to hide?
Well, I don't really hide, but I do keep some things to myself. Not everything is up for conversation. Not everything is up for art. But do I really discern what is and what's not? That's the question. Most of the time, particularly with this record, The Light of the Sun, I've really just been standing in front of a microphone and blacking out musically. You know, I come back a couple hours later and there's 6 songs from beginning to end. You know, I don't know what I'm going to say. I don't know how I'm going to say it. I don't even know what the musicians are going to play, nor do they. You know, it's just been happening that way. It's like we're taking musical journeys.
Woke up this morning listening to this song. You're so blessed. Yes, yes. Gonna rock this joint all day long. You're so blessed. Yes.
This energy and these lyrics and truth and vulnerability and power and passion and all this stuff is pouring out. I don't judge it. I don't beat it up, and I don't question it either. You know, if it's here, it's for a reason. If it's coming out the way it is, it's for a reason. And that's pretty much the way I look at it. You know, I think about Miles Davis saying that there's no mistakes in music. You know, there's no wrong note. And I kind of live by that.
Where does your inspiration come from?
My mother is a genius. She just kept feeding me art on whatever we had, paper plate, silver platter, didn't matter. You know, she just kept feeding it to me. So we went to see all kinds of theater. We would go to the art museum pretty much every Sunday, and I would watch her. She let me know that art was supposed to touch. You know, some paintings, she would cry, you know, standing in front of a painting. I didn't know why, but it touched her. She really just gave me the freedom to appreciate art and to be artistic.
I'm speaking with singer, poet, and actress Jill Scott about her new album, The Light of the Sun. You've taken on a number of different, very memorable film and TV roles in a very short period. One of them was in the ensemble cast of Tyler Perry's Why Did I Get Married? And you played Sheila, a pretty passive wife who took a lot of psychological abuse from her husband, a husband she later finds out is cheating.
I thought that God had given up on me. Because here I am in this marriage and it don't work. He don't love me. He don't like me.
This was a very real, very raw character. How did you get there?
For me, it's all about the writing first. And then I look into this character and create her. You know, all the little nuances, how she walks, how she sits, if she stands with a bowed head. I looked at the way Sheila was being treated. And I hurt for her, so that allowed me to hurt being her.
Sheila actually reminds me a little bit of the song Hear My Call, number 7 on your new album, The Light of the Sun.
I am such a fool. How did I get here? Played by all the rules, then they changed. I am but a child to your vision. Standing in the cold and the rain, lost here in the dark, I can't see my foot to take a step. What is happening? All this hurts so bad, I can hardly breathe. I just wanna leave. So God,
it's such a beautiful song. It's so raw. It sounds so theatrical almost. Is that what you were going for?
Yeah, it does. Even when I listen to it, it makes me get quiet. It is meant to be theatrical. Emotion is supposed to be evoked. It's music.
God, please hear my call. I am afraid for me.
It's so human, you know? And I know I'm not the only one who's ever felt lost and confused by a broken heart. You know, it's actually very difficult for me to sing live because I have to embody those things in order to give permission to everyone else in the audience to feel something, mm-hmm. You know. So here's free music with some flaws, some mistakes that I wouldn't touch if you paid me. I would not auto-tune a thing. I wouldn't do it.
Do you play an instrument of any kind?
I do not.
How do you put the music to the words?
Well, I have a great team of musicians they blow me away. I normally give them the beat with my mouth. I normally give them the notes, and then I describe the textures. So I'll tell them it's in the South, It's hot. There's mosquitoes everywhere. But you can't. There's mosquitoes, and you're drinking corn liquor to keep the mosquitoes away. And your favorite woman, not your only woman, your favorite woman has decided that she's going to marry somebody else. Now play.
What would the baseline for that sound like?
I would say really guttural. Ba-dunk, boom, 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 something to that effect. And then I would tell the drummer that the snare is, it's on fire and you just need to fan it. So you've got the boom, 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 and then the ching, sh, sh, ching. You know, and then it starts to happen. It's more like we're communicating with each other and painting a picture that gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then I come in and I lay whatever lines are on my mind. And then we've got this moment, and it's music, and it's alive, and it's happening now.
I want to play another track from the CD. This is called Womanifesto.
I am not going to lie and pacify. I am arms to hold. I am lips to speak. I am a motherfucking G. Strong legs that stroll off the 33 bus or out of a money green phantom comfortably. Knees that bend to pray, clean from Ajax washings. Hair that is thick and soft. Thighs that betwixt an amazing all expense grand prize. I am eyes that sing.
Not many singers put a poem on their new R&B album. Why did you do it?
I had been looking around and noticing that women were really compartmentalizing themselves as well as allowing society to, you know, pull apart our pieces. And I, you know, it frustrates me because what were we fighting for? Equal pay is one thing, but there's the whole of a woman. In a whole of a person, and that has to be respected as well. It's not just her eyes or her breast or her booty or whatever. I mean, there's an all of you, and that is my womanifesto, and I would hope that other women would write theirs, you know, just to value the rest of you is massive, and it's, for me, it's been life-altering.
Jill, thanks so much for coming in today.
My pleasure.
I'm the one you really want, but you just can't see it. I tried and tried to make you understand, won't believe it.
That's Jill Scott's latest single, Shame, from her new album, The Light of the Sun. It comes out Tuesday, but until then, you can sample every track from the record at our website, nprmusic.org.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.